Red Handed is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Chime is changing the way people bank. It's not just another banking app. Chime unlocks fee-free and smarter banking that's built for you, not the 1%. Forget overdraft fees, minimum balance fees, and monthly fees. Chime turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. Features like MyPay give you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime. And you can even get paid up to 2 days early. Earn up to 3% APY on your savings, 7 times higher than a traditional bank. And the Chime card is the newest way to unlock safer credit building and cashback all on one card, with no annual fees, no interest, and no strings attached. My younger self would really have benefited from something like this. Chime is not just smarter banking. It is the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services, a secured Chime Visa credit card, and MyPay line of credit provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. MyPay eligibility requirements apply, and credit limit ranges $20 to $500. Optional services and products may have fees or charges. See chime.com/fees info. Advertised annual percentage yield with Chime Plus status only. Otherwise, 1.00% APY applies. No min balance required. Chime card on-time payment history may have a positive impact on your credit score. Results may vary. See chime.com for details and applicable terms.
Hey guys, before we start the show today, this is really the last run up to the People's Choice for the British Podcast Awards. If you haven't had a chance to cast a vote for us yet, we would love you to. It literally takes 2 seconds. The link is in the description for this episode. Give us a click. And if you remember, we are into bribery this year. So if we get into the top 10, we will be giving you a whole extra episode. If you're into that, you want us to win, give us a vote. On with the show.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome to part two of our David Parker Ray House of Horrors Toy Box Torture Caravan extravaganza that is also red-handed this week. I hope you've all had some time to recover, but it's over now because we're going to finish the story. Last week, we left you just before the police entered the white trailer in the yard of 513 Bass Road, which was the home of David Parker Ray and his live-in girlfriend, Cindy Hendy. And before we take you inside that white trailer, let's do a quick recap of the story so far. We don't want any of you to get lost along the way. Last week, we met 4 women who all had encounters with David Parker Ray and his family in the 90s. First, we met Kelly Van Cleve, who went missing for 3 days in 96, then was dropped home by Parker Ray with no memory of where she had been, but she did retain a fear of duct tape and would have hellish nightmares in which she was being chained to a table. Then we dropped into 1997 and spent some time with Marie Parker, who disappeared from the Blue Water Saloon in Elephant Butte after being seen with Parker Ray's daughter, Jessie Ray. Dennis Roy Yancey was also in the bar that night, and we're going to explore his relationship with David Parker Ray in a lot more detail in this episode. The next woman we met was Angelica Montagno, who was picked up on the side of the road by useless Deputy Sheriff Gary Labour. Angelica told Gary all about her days of extended, violent, sexual torture at 513 Bass Road. But useless Gary did nothing about it until we met Cynthia Vigil.
Cynthia was the last woman we met last week. She had been snatched from a car park in Albuquerque and driven the 150 miles back to Bass Road in Elephant Butte. There, she had been restrained, electrocuted, and violated for days before making her escape. Once she broke free, she ran down the streets of Elephant Butte totally naked, covered in cuts and bruises, and with a collar and a chain around her neck. The authorities caught up with her, due to a series of 911 calls. Cynthia then told the police every detail of what David Parker Ray and Cindy Hendy had done to her. After the police heard Cynthia's harrowing tale, David Parker Ray and Cindy Hendy were arrested pretty quickly. They didn't give much away at all, though. Parker Ray and Cindy Hendy told the cops that they had chained Cynthia up in their house to stop her from using heroin and to get her through the worst of her cold turkey phase. Yeah, sounds like standard protocol.
Standard practice. Just chain them up naked by the neck in your living room. Not even in the cellar.
No.
Just in full view of the house.
And obviously, the police didn't buy this story. And 513 was searched. Both Angelica and Cynthia had recalled being played a cassette tape by David Parker Ray, in which he detailed calmly all of the horrendous things he and his lady had in store for the kidnapped victims.
And I know you all went and read it when I specifically told you not to. I'm watching you.
There was some pretty traumatized people on the Facebook group after they'd gone and read it.
And you've got only yourselves to blame because I did try.
Same with the Ian Watkins court transcripts. Told you guys not to read it. I bet you did.
Yeah.
And any of you didn't, after this, you're going to go find it and read it. I know you will. We are gluttons.
Gluttons. I don't even know what the... I don't even know. I was trying to think of like a... Oh my God, what are those phrases called where like the devil makes work for idle hands? What's that? It's a...
Like a pronoun. No, a pronoun. Oh my God.
A parable? No.
A proverb?
Proverb. That's it. That's it. The proverb of don't read things when Hannah and Saruti tell you not to. Brand new one.
There you go. I feel like they should be like Bible verses. Don't, not that I'm comparing us
I am.
To Jesus before anyone freaks out and yells at me. So this tape that we know you guys have gone and read the transcript for, we know you've done it. This search that the police do at this point is when they uncovered that tape. But the tape presented a problem too, though, because it started, remember, with a disclaimer claiming that this was all just for entertainment purposes only. And this is kind of like, do you remember when we did the Colleen Stan one?
Mm-hmm.
And he had the master-slave contract, but he'd literally just taken it out of a fucking BDSM magazine.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And we come across this whenever we do a case that even remotely touches on BDSM, we always have to have this conversation surrounding consent, which obviously we should be doing that. There's so many elements of this case where you don't know whether he's putting it in there to cover his arse or whether it genuinely isn't true. And with some elements of this case, I genuinely don't know.
No, I don't know. I think, okay, my thoughts on this. I don't think David Parker Ray was smart enough to, legally speaking, to think, let me put this in for entertainment purposes only so that if I ever do get caught for this horrendous stuff I'm doing, I can say that it was just consensual. Maybe, but I don't know if he's that, like, legally savvy to think in loopholes like that. What I think maybe happened was potentially he was originally, you know, hiring sex workers or, you know, getting into relationships with women and doing it like a consensual BDSM sitch. Remember, he rehearsed that tape. He wrote it down, he recorded it loads and loads of times. And maybe the first iteration of when that tape was played was for entertainment purposes only. But David Parker Ray quickly realizes that consent and consensual BDSM, like a normal person practicing that, wasn't for him and it wasn't getting him off the way he wanted. So he moves into what he does, but he just continues to use the old tape because he fucking loves the sound of his own voice.
He loves the sound of his own voice. And I think, like you said last week, like the tape just mechanizes the whole situation. I think he just couldn't be asked to do it again.
Yeah. And here you go. This one worked.
Yeah. And I think when it comes to Cynthia Vierhill, because she was a sex worker and because just people don't seem to believe women in this story, a lot of people think that she started out as a willing participant in this bondage situation and then maybe it got too much for her or he said he wasn't going to pay her and that's when she broke free and caused all of this fuss. And maybe, I don't think this, but maybe you could argue that all of the women were willing participants, at least in the beginning, perhaps. So maybe they agree to go to the toy box and then it all gets too much and that blah, blah, blah. But I think there are definitely some bits of evidence that we'll deal with this week that make me think that David Parker Ray and to a certain extent Cindy Hendy and even Jesse Ray and Dennis Yancey were all predators picking off vulnerable women to satisfy David Parker Ray's sexual needs. Parker Ray explains it himself in his cassette tape when he says, quote, masochists are rare as hell. and before you all lose your minds, I am not a kink expert, but here's my thinking on this. If David Parker Ray really did, let's pretend this is true for a second. If he really did have this decades-long career of sexual sadism, how likely is it that all of the women were willing participants? In the tape, he claims he recorded it in 1993. We don't really have any proper way of knowing if that is true or not. It could be another layer in an elaborate fiction. But if we accept that the tape was made in 1993, that gives him years before he is caught in 1999. And if, as he suggests in the tape, he really did get bored of women quite quickly, then the list of women he violated could be, in theory, endless. But again, we're coming up against this question of consent, like we always do with any cases that even touch on BDSM. Like, I am by no means saying that masochists don't exist. Of course they do. All I'm doing is asking the question that in that isolated area of New Mexico where he lived, is it likely that there would be 50 women who would willingly participate in that kind of extreme sexual relationship? And it is extreme.
It is. And especially during that time period.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I just feel like, no. There's no argument to me to be made that all of these women, or really maybe any of these women, maybe in the very, very beginning, maybe, yes. But I don't think they knew what they were consenting to, obviously, because we know what he goes on and does to them. But no. I don't buy it at all. I think we can put that to bed.
So here's what I think. For David Parker Ray, a guy who crushes taboos, he eats taboos for breakfast. For him, consent was the last taboo to be broken. He needed his victims to not be consenting, or it just wasn't as good. And I am also inclined to believe that his BDSM career really was decades long, just because of the sheer number of sex toys and restraints that were found in his house. Because remember, he doesn't just have a fuck dungeon. He has an entire fuck house. He didn't even try to hide it. And 1,000 pieces of evidence were taken from his home. Which, just in case we need to remind you and it's not emblazoned on your brain forever, the evidence taken from 513 Bass Road included homemade dildos made of scrap metal, hooks, handcuffs, whips, chains, shackles, metal collars, and motorized torture machines. Some of the contents of the house looked shop-bought and some of them looked entirely homemade. A little gem that we didn't tell you last week is that one of the homemade items was designed specifically to stretch breast tissue as far as it would go. And I really don't think I can describe much more of these items of evidence without the show turning into some hardcore audio porn. So I am just going to leave it there. Again, if you want to find the descriptions, they are extremely easy to find. There are photographs and diagrams too, if you really want to scar yourself for life.
It's like medieval torture implements.
But also like electric, like pounding dildos.
Oh my God.
Sorry, I said I wouldn't say it and then I said it. I'm sorry, guys.
The thing is, as if that wasn't scary enough, the contents of the house was nothing compared to the contents of the white trailer in the yard. The famous toy box had taken over $100,000 and years to complete. On the 17th of March, 1999, the Elephant Butte police, accompanied by the FBI, and with the help of a locksmith, opened the white doors of the 15 by 25 foot trailer. And the fuck house had absolutely nothing on this. Inside the toy box was a gynecological chair, complete with stirrups. There was also a mirror on the ceiling, so that the person in the chair could see absolutely everything that was being done to them. The toy box also had a fur-lined coffin, steel leg spreaders in all different sizes, and more electric shock machines just like in the house. There were whips, chains, pulleys, straps, clamps, surgical scalpels, saws, and, of course, yet another collection of enormous dildos. Parker Ray assured his victims in his tape recording that they would never be expected to take something bigger than the size of a baby's head inside them.
Do you think we need to explain to the children at home what a cassette tape is?
That's hilarious. Yes, go on then. I don't know how.
Before we had CDs.
CDs.
And before we had MP3s, we had cassette tapes. You put them in a cassette tape player, your car would have a cassette tape player, and you could also record direct off the radio.
Yeah, and it was filled with ribbon, like it was made of magic.
And then sometimes your tape recorder would eat the ribbon and then you'd have to squirrel it back in with a pencil. Those were hours of fun.
Hours of fun.
And then eventually they would
stop working.
Die. Yeah. And it would be a really sad day for you.
I remember the first cassette tape I ever wore out was the soundtrack to Disney's Aladdin.
That's amazing. Don't know what. I used to do it all the time because I listened to like story tapes constantly when I was a kid, me and my sister. And it got to the point where I could, especially, I think there was two or three of them. Carrie's War was one, When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, and then something else, very war-themed books as a child. I could stop them at any point. And these are like 8 cassette long books. I could stop it at any point and I could tell you what the end of the sentence was. That's how much I listened to it.
Wow. Round of applause for Hannah Maguire there.
I still listen to Carrie's War when I'm like, really need to go to sleep. It's on YouTube. Top tip.
Right. Back to...
Sorry. Brief jaunt into childhood nostalgia and now back to giant dildos.
And the rather harrowing sentence I just uttered of the fact that they would never have to take anything larger than the size of a baby's head inside them. So
yep.
Thanks for that, Parker, Ray. You're so considerate.
That's the thing. He thinks he's a fucking doctor, man. Like, he's just like, oh, well, your vagina can withstand this much. Therefore, I will not expect you to do this, this, or this.
And in the white trailer, there was also a Colleen Stan type box that David Parker Ray would put over his victims' heads. It had a hole for their face. And I have no idea what that was for, but I can only imagine that it was not very nice if it's happening to
you. It's like the first one that they, when they get Colleen in the car.
Yeah.
And they put it on her head. It's like that one. It's like a...
the clam box that's on Instagram.
Exactly. It's just for her head.
Oh, and also the toy box trailer was also almost totally soundproof. And houses anyway were pretty far apart in Elephant Butte. So the chances of neighbours hearing what was going on in the toy box and alerting the authorities was virtually zero. There were also CCTV cameras and motion sensors inside the hellish torture caravan. Just as David Parker Ray had described in his cassette recording... there was a large sign on one of the walls of the trailer that read Satan's Den, and another that read, if she's worth taking, she's worth keeping. And that's not all either. A lot of things found in the toy box were mentioned in the cassette tape, including syringes, sodium pentothal, and phenobarbital. Parker Ray claims in the tape that these drugs would render his victims unconscious and also erase every memory of their time in the toy box and at 513. Again, he's just like buying these random drugs and then concocting a cocktail, giving it to his victims and saying, yeah, that'll sort you right out. You won't remember a thing. He's not a fucking chemist.
He literally thinks he is, though, and that's the thing. So when I first read that, I was like, I don't know, because I am not a chemist or a pharmacist or a doctor. I don't know whether those drugs in combination would cause the effects that he claims that they are. So I had a look into it. And it looks reasonably likely that those drugs would have that effect on some people sometimes. So sodium pentothal, which also in some places in America, they call it Fatal Plus.
Oh, wow.
What?
Fatal Plus.
That's not how you market a drug, I'm afraid.
Unless you're marketing a drug to kill people, in which case that's a great name.
Well, and it sort of is, I suppose. So... sodium pentothal can be used to induce periods of general anesthesia. So that's the unconscious part of what David Parker Ray was describing. And it can also be used to initiate a medically induced coma, presumably in differing amounts.
So that's like fatal light when you just want that bit.
Yeah, fatal light. Yeah. Semi-mortal. Also, sodium pentothal is what most states give to death row prisoners to knock them out before they are given a lethal injection. And interestingly, sodium pentothal has a reputation for being a truth serum, and the theory behind this is as follows. The drug suppresses your central nervous system, so your brain function is suppressed as well, and lying is a lot more difficult than telling the truth. So you're less likely to lie because your brain thinks it's too much like hard work. But obviously, Parker Ray does not want his victims to tell the truth, so this is where the phenobarbital comes in. Phenobarbital, like sodium pentothal, is a barbiturate that depresses the central nervous system non-selectively and is used as a sedative hypnotic. Phenobarbital controls abnormal brain activity and as such can be used to treat seizures, and memory loss is a known side effect. So I think the idea here that Parker Ray is going for, he would give you the combination of sodium pentothal and phenobarbital in order to induce an isolated bout of amnesia before setting his victims free. And I feel like, as I said, I feel like that is possible. But the thing is, we already know that Parker Ray did not have a 100% success rate, despite boasting so in his tape, because Angelica Montagno remembered every single thing. So he's not as good as he thinks he is.
No, not at all. But even that wasn't the end of the treasure trove trailer. The toy box, like the house, was covered in graphic drawings of BDSM sex positions, and also, rather tackily, I thought, a lot of plastic skulls.
There is a plastic skull candelabra that's just like one skull with like three plastic. Like, you know, sometimes at Christmas, people put like a triangle thing in their window that's not a menorah, but it's like what Christians do instead of a menorah. And sometimes they have like plastic candles. It's like that.
Oh my God.
But on a skull.
I mean, fucking fuck off, David. You're an idiot. And of course, classic. We are in the 90s after all. There were also a lot of references to Satanism and the occult. David Parker Ray was the leader of the Elephant Butte chapter of the Church of Satan. Or so at least he claimed. No one else seems to be able to back that up at all. And I don't know whether he was actually a Satanist or whether he thought it just fit in with the whole like dungeon master vibe.
He's not a Satanist. No way.
No, he's just a guy who likes fucking spooky shit and pushing taboos, and he thinks it's creepy and cool, and he's...
That's exactly it. He just thinks it fits in with his joie de vivre.
General aesthetic.
Exactly, yeah.
Just to clarify, we don't think that he was actually a practicing Satanist. And if you want a deeper look into Satanism and what it actually is, go and have a listen to our Fall River cult episode. Now, there is another piece of myth connected to the toy box, which I find really, really disturbing. More so even than everything else we've been talking about.
I think about this bit the most, I think.
Because some report that a woman who was hired by the FBI to sketch the inside of the toy box killed herself a week after. Now, we found absolutely no evidence to back this up at all. I really think it might just be a rumor. And even if it is true, we have no way of knowing what else that poor woman was going through. I don't think we can put her death down to the insides of the toy box. But some people do. And all it does is add to the mythology of this case. And quite frankly, the much desired notoriety and mythology that David Parker Ray himself wanted.
Oh, absolutely. That's the thing that, like, I really didn't know whether I should put that bit in or not, because I just felt like it might be, if it is true, it might just strike the wrong tone. But I put it in because I just think it's...
It's to take apart the mythology. That's the important thing. We don't want to feed into
that.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, we don't know if it's true or not, but people talk about it as if it is true. And, you know, we don't know what was going on with her. Like, it could have been a million things if it's even true. But I think it's just like, oh, it was so shocking. She couldn't handle it. And she, come on, man.
It's like, just the classic thing of when tragedies occur around, like when tragedies occur around horror films, like the filming of horror films.
Yeah.
The film was cursed. The set was cursed. And it was like, you know.
Yeah. Oh, he had a heart attack when he watched The Exorcist.
Well, if those things had happened while you're fucking filming, I don't know, like bloody Marley and Me, no one's going to be like, the set of Marley and Me is haunted. Like,
Marley and Me.
I don't know why that film was in my head. It's such a sad film. I hate it.
I refuse to watch it. I've never watched it.
I don't know why I ended up watching it. You know, I hate sad films. I've watched the two saddest films I've ever watched in my life that made me just weep were Marley and Me and Lion, and I can't cope. I hate it. Absolutely hate it. Remember watching Marley and Me at home, and my mum gave up halfway through. We have a lab, and she was like, nope, and she left. And then she went and had a shower, came back about half an hour later, and I was sat like a foot away from the TV sobbing. And she was like, why are you still watching this?
That's so funny.
It's the bit where he's like, I know I said you were a bad dog, but you're not. You're the best dog ever. When the dog's dying.
You've just ruined it for everyone.
Oh, fuck. Come on. Everyone knows the dog. If there is a movie about a dog, the dog is going to die. Facts.
Not in Beethoven Returns.
Well, in Beethoven Returns 2, that's what they're planning.
There are so many Beethoven movies. I don't think he dies in any of them. I made the mistake of watching It's a Wonderful Life on a plane once and just sobbing, so uncontrollably sobbing in between these two giant German men who like did not know what to do with themselves at all. And they were just like, do we... You could see the cogs turning in their heads being like, is she okay? Oh, do we leave her to it? Is she just
no.
Like this? I am just like that.
Brilliant.
Right, sorry, where are we?
Back in the toy box.
Back in the toy. I'm not sure I even want to call it the toy box anymore because that's what he calls it and he think he quite likes it.
Back in the trailer.
Let's call it the torture caravan.
Yeah.
So after they've cracked open the torture caravan and found all of this horrendous stuff inside, which all correlates with not only what David Parker Ray himself said in the cassette tape, but also with the testimony of Angelica and of Cynthia Vigil, you might think that things are looking pretty bleak for David Parker Ray and his girlfriend accomplice, Cindy. And you're right, it is not looking great. But it's not looking like murder either. All the police and the FBI have at this stage is a BDSM dungeon, a fuck house, and a whole stack of medical questionnaires. Cynthia Vigil told the police that she was raped, tortured, and violated against her will, but not everyone believed her. We know that Parker Ray and Hendy told police that they've been trying to see Cynthia through the worst of her heroin withdrawal. They do not tell the police at this stage that Cynthia was a willing participant in some sort of BDSM relationship situation. But once David Parker Ray was presented with the contents of his fuckhouse and torture caravan, Parker Ray claimed that all of the women who were ever in his torture caravan or in his house were there willingly. And he never wavered from this story, even for a second.
Yeah, if I was trying to kick a massive heroin addiction to the point that I need to be chained up in someone's house, you know, just to take the edge off, I'd love to engage in some casual BDSM. Just to take it off, you know, take all the heroin off my mind.
And also, like, why are you pretending you're such a, like, such a saint? Oh, I just found this sex worker and she was in trouble. I'm going to take her into my house and chain her up. Come on. Parker Ray admitted that some of the women who came to his house and into the torture caravan were sex workers, but he claimed that he never took anyone in there against their will. My problem with that is this. If that is true, if every single woman was there willingly, why are you drugging them? If they are there so willingly, why do you need to go to such lengths to make them forget everything that happened? If they were into it, surely they would want to remember.
And Cindy Hendy was quick to supply the answers to all these questions to the police. She didn't hold out to protect David Parker Ray at all. Police questioned her very soon after her arrest, and she cracked like an egg. It's pretty vital to the case that Hendy was just as involved as Parker Ray in the torture of these women. She watched them in the house, she chained them up, and she also sexually abused them. People often forget that, but don't, because it's important. There really was no way that she could pretend that she didn't know what was going on. So to protect herself, she dobbed David Parker Ray right in it. Cindy had a traumatic childhood. She was sexually abused by her stepfather, and no one believed her when she told them. Not even her mum. As an adult, Hendy entered into a string of abusive relationships. She also dabbled in drugs and made the mistake of dealing cocaine to an undercover cop in Seattle. So after this mishap, Cindy Hendy was sent on a drug counselling course. But she wasn't having any of it. She skipped town and ended up in New Mexico. Apparently the nickname for New Mexico is the Land of Enchantment.
I thought that was hilarious. Every American state has like a different...
Really?
Like the Sunshine State or the like something something.
And New Mexico is the Land of Enchantment.
Apparently. And so the best one, I think, and they also all have a motto, like every state has a motto. New Hampshire's is live free or die.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. And Kentucky's is unbridled spirit, which I thought was quite good because they've got horses and bourbon.
That's smart. It's very Game of Thronesy, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
It sounds like something from like The Land That Time Forgot.
The Land Before Time. Maybe there's just dinosaurs in New Mexico. Maybe that's it.
Now, when she was in the Land of Enchantment, Hendy got a string of other criminal charges under her belt, including a drink driving and assault charge. One of these crimes landed her a community service sentence, which she had to carry out at the Elephant Butte State Park. And remember, that's where Mr. David Parker Ray was, what did we call him?
Scooby-Dooing about, just being a Scooby-Doo baddie.
Scooby-Dooing about being the security guard for nature's roller coaster.
I think he was a mechanic, but sure.
Yeah, he was the mechanic at Elephant Butte State Park.
Same diff.
This is obviously where she met him. The pair hit it off immediately, and it didn't take too long for them to discover their shared passion for sadism. Everything they do is totally fucked up, right? But how hard is it to meet someone and you're like, oh my God, you're into that too? That's amazing.
I know.
And they're just in this small town hanging out in Elephant Butte State Park and they're like, you're into horribly torturing people and sadism? Oh my God, me too. Fucking hell.
Well, this is the thing that I wonder about Cindy Hendy, because I think some people are of the opinion that he just sort of took her, because she's significantly younger than him, that he just sort of takes her under his sadist wing and molds her.
Yeah, because she's 20 years younger than him, isn't she?
But there was, if he had some sort of like, if she was under his spell or whatever, I hate that phrase, but say if she hypothetically was, she wouldn't have dobbed him in the first 5 minutes. I think she can stick up for herself, can Cindy Hendy, I think.
I agree. I don't know how into it she was as much as he was, but I think she strikes me as the kind of person, because of how transient her life is, because of the, she goes from abusive relationship to abusive relationship. I kind of think she would be the kind of person that would be like, okay, what is this person into? Let me be into that to some extent to try have some sort of situation here, potentially.
Yeah, but it's that's a big ask. Yeah.
It's a big leap.
And I don't think she's sort of standing and watching either. I think
no,
she's
absolutely
very
not.
Involved.
She's a Myra. She's a Rose. She's into this. You can put her alongside those women.
Red Handed is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. These days, I'm all about quality over quantity. Buy nice over buy twice. I've had way too many of my clothes wear out after less than a year of wearing them. So now, if it's not well made and versatile, it's not coming in. That's honestly why I love Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the cuts are thoughtful, and crucially, the pricing actually makes sense. Quince makes high-quality wardrobe staples using premium fabrics like 100% European linen, 100% silk, and organic cotton poplin. These are versatile, well-made pieces that make getting dressed simple without paying some crazy markup. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middleman. So you're not paying for the brand or for fancy retail stores. You're just paying for quality clothing. Right now, go to quince.com/redhanded for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to wear it and love it, and you will. Now available in Canada too. Don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/redhanded for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/redhanded.
Starting something new can be exciting, but also terrifying. When we first started Red Handed, we had no idea if anyone would even want to listen to two strangers bang on about true crime. But here we are, nearly a decade later, and we were completely right to believe in ourselves and launch the podcast you're listening to right now, despite the crippling fear. It also helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses all around the world, and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Gymshark and Mattel to those just getting started. Want people to learn about your brand? Shopify creates email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. It's like you've got a whole marketing team behind you, even if it's just you and your laptop. And if you get stuck, Shopify's always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/redhanded. Go to shopify.com/redhanded. That's shopify.com/redhanded.
Hendy moved in with Parker Ray at 513 Bass Road, but they only got together 8 months before Cynthia Vigil escaped the house. So you have to wonder who, the woman that David Parker Ray describes as his lady in the tapes that he claimed to have recorded in 1993. Hendy had more information for the police than they could have ever imagined. She explained that Parker Ray would pick up sex workers, usually with substance abuse issues, because he knew that they wouldn't be missed. And sometimes he would let them go, and sometimes, according to Hendy, if they caused too much trouble, he would kill them.
So she's literally only been on the scene for 8 months. If we believe him, he has been at this for decades. So his accomplice list must be pretty long.
So that's 6 years before, at least 5 years before he meets Cindy Hendy, if we believe that that's when they were recorded. Because with the cassette, we have no idea when it was recorded.
Yeah, I haven't seen any sort of detail. Maybe it is possible to, like, carbon date a cassette tape. I don't know. I haven't seen it disputed in many places, so maybe it was, but I'm just saying that I haven't been able to, off the back of my own reading, confirm whether that was actually, that's just what he says.
So Cindy is basically telling the police that this wasn't just what they thought, like some sort of catch, rape, torture, abuse, release program that he was running, that he actually killed some of these women. And she went into a lot of detail. She told the police that after Parker Ray killed these women, he would open up their chest cavities, fill the body with rocks, and then put them in the Elephant Butte Lake, knowing that they wouldn't resurface. That's very specific.
It is, isn't it? And probably quite efficient.
And he had free reign of that park. I mean, national parks are fucking huge. I don't know how big this one is, but how hard would it be for him to dump some bodies in the lake and never get spotted?
Not very.
Whether he did use the lake or not, we don't know, but he would have absolutely known the best places for hiding bodies. And they must have been, if he did kill these women, pretty perfect hiding places, because no bodies have ever been found.
Or maybe there were no bodies at all. With this case, it's very difficult to know. But let's assume that there were bodies to dispose of. The lake is pretty perfect for it. It's absolutely massive. At its highest water level, it can hold...
Just say 2 million.
Something like 2 million acre-feet of water. I tried to look up what that is in litres, but it just came up with an enormous number to the power of 12. So let's just say it is massive.
Also, I've never heard the phrase acre-feet of water.
I think it's an American thing.
How interesting.
Odd. I've never, ever come across it either. So when we say massive, we mean extremely difficult to search. The only real way to know what was on the bottom of the Elephant Butte Lake would be to drain it. And considering the lake provides irrigation to 178,000 acres of land, there was just no way of doing that without causing major disruption.
And David Parker Ray would probably have known that.
Oh, he 100% would have known that. Hendy told the police that she believed that Parker Ray had been killing his entire adult life. His first kill was at 20 years old, and he'd never looked back. That's what she says. As we know from last week, that conflicts against what his first wife said. This is Cindy Hendy, I don't know, like so many things she says are quite inconsistent. We'll get there. Hendy tells police that Parker Ray needed a non-consenting partner to get off at all. The pain inflicted on a consenting adult in a safe BDSM kind of way did not cut it for him.
It's just like exactly the same comparison you could make between someone who just wants to have sex with a consenting normal person and someone who is a rapist. The non-consent is what they want, otherwise they would just not be rapists. Like, it's exactly the same thing.
Hendy claimed that Parker Ray's body count was as high as 30 people, 18 of which he had killed in New Mexico, but most of the bodies were dumped in the neighbouring states of Texas or Arizona. Hendy was adamant that Parker Ray had never shown her a single body dump site and she had no idea where they were. So which one is it, Cindy? Is he dumping them all in the lake or is he driving them to Texas and Arizona? That doesn't really make sense to me.
And also she's like saying that she knows that the bodies are in the lake because he told her, but she's also like, he never showed me a dump site and I now have no idea where they are.
This is what I mean with her. Like she's very inconsistent with detail and she gets people's names wrong a lot and it's just a bit, I don't know.
She's not 100% credible.
No, she's not. And
she has an agenda. She's fucking in this up to her neck as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Some things about Cindy Hendy's story, though, did make sense because she was able to tell the police all about the abduction of Angelica Montaño, although she did refer to Angelica as Angela, as we said. But I don't know. Maybe you can forgive her for that.
Yeah, I think I can this time.
She certainly does worse things when put into perspective. She also said to the police that they should dig up the backyard and that David Parker Ray kept a meticulous photo diary of his conquests, but that he would periodically burn them. Okay. Does seem weird for a man who kept everything for him to make notes like that photo diary and then burn them.
He's got his pile of trinkets, right, which they have not managed to trace to anyone. I think he is actually pretty smart. He's been doing this for decades and he's got away with it. And so I think he's just very good at destroying evidence.
In return for all this information, Hendy was rewarded by the police a reduced sentence for her participation in Parker Ray's depraved schemes. Whilst awaiting her trial, Hendy received a stack of love letters from Parker Ray. He promised to marry her and even got a tattoo of her on his arm. Nothing says love like a jailhouse tattoo of your face on my arm.
If I was in prison, I'd get loads of tattoos. I'm in prison. I was going to do my dissertation on prison tattoos, but then I decided that I didn't want to go into a male prison on my own at 23.
No, I think that sounds like an excellent decision that you made there. What are you going to jail for that you're like, I'm in prison, I might as well get loads of tattoos on my face and neck or whatever you're planning?
No one said face or neck.
I'm saying it.
Hands and feet only.
Why are you getting secret tattoos? You have to get visible tattoos.
That's true. I don't know. I definitely would, though, if I was in prison.
In November 1999, after all the love letters and the tattooing and all this, Hendy attempted, unbelievably, to recant her confession. She claimed that the terms of her plea deal had not been properly explained. But this didn't wash with the judge, and in January 2000, Hendy was told that she had to stick to the previously agreed terms. It was too late for her to change her mind now. So Hendy was eventually sentenced to 36 years. And police dug up the yard at 513 just like Hendy had suggested and found absolutely nothing. Not a single trace of human remains.
That's what I mean. She's not that reliable. She's like, no, promise you, like, you have to dig up the yard. And then they found some like animal bones or something, but that was it. There was nothing.
Unless he was gaslighting her and telling her that he was burying, killing girls to keep her in line and burying them in the garden, but he was actually dumping them somewhere else.
Or maybe he wasn't killing anyone at all. This is what I don't know.
I just think a man who crosses lines the way that David Parker Wray does and did for such a long time, I can't believe that he wouldn't go to the next level and kill them.
Mm.
The only reason I could think that he wouldn't is, like I mentioned, my thinking in the first episode, which is that he wants them to stay alive so that their suffering continues because he's a sadist. Even to have accidentally killed a couple of women, the things he was fucking doing, like...
Yeah.
I don't know. Whatever Cindy said, whatever's going on, the police don't find any remains, so who knows how much of what Cindy Hendy said was actually true. But Cindy did turn the authorities onto another person of interest. We actually already met him in part one. Marie Parker's violent ex-boyfriend, Dennis Yancey. Cindy Hendy also told police that Dennis Yancey had killed Marie Parker under David Parker Wray's orders and that they had driven her body out to the desert. That was why Marie Parker had disappeared without a trace. But she insisted that Parker Wray had never told her where exactly the body was.
And honestly, Marie Parker is the closest they get to a murder charge. Yancey, as we know from part one, was a piece of work. Like Parker Wray, he had a brief stint in the military. He was in the Navy. In 1999, Yancey was just 27 years old, but he'd already been convicted of domestic violence and rape. Yancey ended up hanging out with Parker Wray because of their shared interest in Satanism and sadism. What a combo. Again, I just don't understand how you, like, discover this about a person. Like, how... What situation does that... Well, I suppose if you just go around to David Parker Wray's house, you're like, okay, this guy probably likes violent sex.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to someone's house and they've got, like, fucking stupid affirmations hanging up everywhere, then you can be like, oh, I assume you're this kind of person. And if you go and they've got loads of fucking hardcore BDSM hanging up on the walls, you're like, oh, are you into sadism? And I noticed your plastic skulls. Satanism?
If you'll remember from last week, when Yancey was a teenager, he tried to start a satanic cult of his own and got Halloween cancelled. So to him, David Parker Wray, possibly a real-life Satanist, was the bee's knees. After Hendy tipped them off, police were quick to call in Yancey for questioning. Yancey admitted that he and Parker Wray would pick up sex workers and abuse them together in the torture caravan, before Hendy was ever on the scene. But, just like Parker Wray, Yancey insisted that this was only ever consensual and that they never abducted anyone or hurt anyone who didn't want to be hurt. But eventually, Yancey cracked just like Hendy did. He did put up a bit more of a fight, but not much. And he admitted that on the 4th of July weekend, 97, he had strangled his ex-girlfriend Marie Parker to death under Parker Wray's instruction. Yancey kept saying in his police interview, "I didn't want to do it. He forced me to do it." We met Marie last week. She went missing from the Blue Waters Saloon in Elephant Butte. Dennis Yancey and Jesse Wray were both there that night. And according to Yancey, this is what happened. Yancey was in Elephant Butte staying with Parker Wray as he was having one of his famous parties to celebrate Independence Day. Yancey and Jesse Wray, that's Parker Wray's daughter, don't forget, left the party for the Blue Waters Saloon, where they found Marie Parker. Yancey and Jesse Wray took Marie into the car park. Then they got into Jesse's truck. They were about to deliver her to David Parker Wray.
Then Yancey climbed on top of Marie in the back of the truck so she couldn't be seen. And they drove off to 513 Bass Road. Parker Wray was waiting for them. When they arrived, he took Marie into the torture caravan. Yancey claimed that he didn't go in there with Marie, but he did admit that he knew exactly what would be happening inside.
I don't believe that for a fucking second.
That he didn't go inside.
Yeah, he went inside.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my God. You don't like abduct a woman, drive her all the way there and then be like, oh, I'm out now. Good. Have fun. I'm off.
Done my bit.
So he claimed that he didn't go inside, but he stayed in the house the whole time drinking beer and even debated, apparently, whether he should call the police.
Lies.
Obviously. Now, there is no way that Marie Parker consented to what was going on in there. Marie Parker, like so many before her, was being held captive at 513 and she was held there for days until Parker Ray decided that it was time for her to go. Parker Ray told Yancey that he knew what he had to do and handed him a rope. Yancey then strangled Marie Parker, who had already endured days of unimaginable torture, to death. Parker Ray photographed the whole thing. Yancey and Parker Ray then drove Marie's body out into the desert and left her in a ravine in Monticello Canyon. Yancey was warned that if he told anyone, he would be next. After this revelation, Yancey was placed under arrest for the murder of Marie Parker and agreed to tell the police where Marie's body was in exchange for a reduced sentence. He went with police to Monticello Canyon to point out where the body dump site was. But again, the police found absolutely nothing. Yancey insisted that Parker Ray must have moved the body to an alternate location. Whilst awaiting trial in prison, Parker Ray got in touch with Yancey, but unlike his love letters to Cindy Hendy, Parker Ray just wrote a note that read, quote, rats die in jail. Yancey tried to get out of his plea deal and told the court that he would be entering a not guilty plea for the murder of Marie. But just like with Cindy Hendy, this was not allowed.
I think what he's trying to do here is he is convinced that they're going to find a body and he knows that that was him. So when they don't find it, he's like, fuck, I should have just kept my mouth shut and now I've implicated myself and I didn't need to because there's no body.
And I don't get a reduced sentence now because there's no body. My information was useless. So why would they give you a reduced sentence?
They give him a reduced charge.
And in the end, Yancey agreed to plead guilty to murder in the second degree in return for 25 years inside, and any subsequent charges connected to Marie Parker would be dropped. No one else was ever charged with the murder of Marie Parker, and there isn't much the police can do without a body.
In June 1999, they thought they might have one. A body, that is. When a fisherman saw a burlap sack floating in Elephant Butte Lake. This sack was found by police to be filled with human remains. But they were so decomposed that the only shot they had at identification would be DNA. But no one had a DNA sample for Marie Parker. I had no idea this was possible, but apparently you can get an approximate reconstruction of a person's DNA with samples from both of their parents.
How interesting.
Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? But Marie Parker's dad refuses because he's like, oh, I was never sure she was my kid anyway.
Fucking hell, Dad.
Suspect, Marie Parker's dad. I think that is very suspect. Why didn't you get a paternity test then? She's an adult woman.
Wow.
He refuses and the police are hit with another dead end. We'll never know if Marie was in the sack in the lake. If you think that is as fucked up as this story gets, buckle up because it is about to get really bad. I cannot believe this is real, but it is. So, if we cast our minds back to the insides of the torture caravan, what the police found on the inside, they found a CCTV setup and they managed to pull footage from those cameras. And there was one particular section of film that caught the police's attention. It starts out with Parker Ray standing in the torture caravan alone, testing the cameras from different angles. Then it cuts to static. And then it comes back on with a woman restrained in the gynecology chair. Her legs are in the stirrups and David Parker Ray does unspeakable things to her. The footage wasn't clear enough to identify the woman's face, but there was one distinguishing feature that was picked up by the cameras. This woman had a tattoo on her left calf. It is really distinctive. I've seen it described as like a tribal swan. I don't know if it is a swan or not, but I can tell you that I have never seen anything like it before or since. It's definitely unique. And the footage that shows the woman in the chair was recorded in July 1996, which is where our story began.
The tattoo was so distinctive that police thought that someone would recognise it, and they were right. A series of tip-offs eventually led back to Kelly Van Cleve, the very first woman we met in the episode last week. The police released an image of the tattoo to the public, and three people came forward to confirm that the tattoo on the woman in the video matched one that belonged to Kelly Van Cleve.
Kelly had a tattoo on her left calf that matched the one in the toy box TV footage exactly. So she was the woman in the video. So now Kelly knew where she had been for those 3 days back in 96 that she couldn't remember. How terrifying is this?
I really wish it wasn't real.
Massively. And after this all came out and Kelly realized what had happened to her during that time, that fear of duct tape started to make a lot more sense. Kelly had since moved on to Colorado, but agreed to come back to New Mexico to tell the police all that she could remember of the night that she went missing. And although Kelly couldn't remember much, she did recall some key details.
As we know from last week, she'd been at the Blue Water Saloon on the evening of the 24th of July 1996. She'd only had one drink, but then she started to feel really unwell. So Jesse Ray offered to give Kelly a lift home on the back of her bike. But she drove Kelly to 513 Bass Road instead, and straight into the hands of her sadistic father. There's something about the fact that it's his daughter, it's Jesse Ray, that's delivering him these women. And I think unlike Cindy Hendy and unlike Dennis Roy Yancey, really, I think he really has a hold over Jesse Ray.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't something you just suddenly bring up over like fucking cereal and newspapers in the morning. It's like he's groomed her for this.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's why she's the most loyal.
Oh, of course.
So after Kelly's interview with the police, Jesse Ray was called in for questioning. Jesse was totally adamant that everything her father had ever done was consensual, and that she certainly had no part in the murder of Marie Parker. I was expecting, if I'm honest, a bit more of a Manson-esque vibe from Parker Ray's immediate circle, because they're just delivering him vulnerable women all the time. But it really is only Jesse Ray that stands by him. Jesse never changed her stance, and eventually she was charged with kidnapping, criminal sexual contact, and conspiracy. She faced a maximum of 150 years in prison. And in June 1999, Jesse Ray entered a plea of not guilty.
And that brings us to the eye of the storm, David Parker Ray himself. He never admitted any guilt and took the same line as his daughter Jesse Ray, that he had only ever taken women into his toy box who wanted to be there. David Parker Ray was prepared for 3 separate trials, one for each of his known surviving victims, all of whom we met in part one. The trial for the kidnap and rape of Kelly Van Cleve was the first. No evidence from the trials of Angelica Montaño or Cynthia V. Hill were permitted by the judge. So the only thing that Kelly's prosecution team had to work with was the video of the footage of her in the gynecologist's chair in the toy box. The cassette recording of Parker Ray detailing what he was about to do to his victims was not allowed to be submitted as evidence because Kelly had no memory of hearing it. And also because of the disclaimer at the beginning that it was only for entertainment purposes. David Parker Ray did not take the stand. His defense's main argument was basically this. Why would he drive her back himself if he had done anything untoward? But I think the answer to that has been the underpinning of this entire case is pure arrogance on Parker Ray's part.
He's been doing this for so long. Like, he's just seeing, and he's obviously a boundary pusher. Like, he's seeing how far he can take it and get away with it.
Of course.
And he does for years.
It's part of the thrill for someone like Parker Ray. Taking her all the way back home, seeing her husband and being like, oh, I picked your wife up. Like, it's part of the game. It's part of the thrill. Now, the footage in the chair that was played to the court was not enough. And the jury, unfortunately, came to a stalemate with 2 jurors refusing to convict Parker Ray. So the judge had no choice other than to declare a mistrial. The 2 jurors who refused to convict him were sure that Kelly was lying and that she had consented to the toy box torture. David Parker Ray's lawyers did a pretty good job of making Kelly look like an untrustworthy person who would do anything for attention.
The Kelly case was retried in November 1999, and in a bizarre twist of fate, the judge who had presided over the first trial died. So another judge was appointed. This new judge did allow the tape recording to be presented to the jury, and it was all they needed. This time round, the jury took 5 hours to find David Parker Ray guilty of Kelly's kidnap and rape. After this conviction, Parker Ray's defense team ran wild with the press. They called his trial a witch hunt for alternative sexual practices. Parker Ray's sentencing was postponed until after he stood trial for the kidnap and rape of Cynthia V. Hill and Angelica Montaño.
But Angelica would never see trial. Unfortunately, she died of pneumonia at just 28 years old, and her case was never taken to court. Jesse Ray was scheduled to stand trial in February of 2000, and David Parker Ray, in what seems like an uncharacteristic show of compassion, agree to enter a plea deal in exchange for all charges against his daughter to be dropped. In return for this, Parker Ray pled guilty to all charges associated with Cynthia Vigil, so that's kidnap and rape. Not a single murder charge was brought against him. This is so important. People call him the toy box killer.
Literally no evidence he killed anyone.
No, he's never been convicted of a murder.
The only thing that comes close is him telling Dennis Yancey to kill Marie. He doesn't kill Marie himself, if we believe Dennis's story.
And that's the thing, it's not even he's never convicted of a murder. He's never even charged with a murder. They've never even found a body. Yeah. Now, a condition of this deal was that Parker Ray would have to give 100 hours of interviews to the FBI to help their criminal profiling team. Parker Ray agreed to these terms, but Jessie didn't get away totally scot-free. She ended up serving 2.5 years, but didn't have to go through a trial. On the 20th of September 2001, all in all for his crimes against Cynthia and Kelly, David Parker Ray was sentenced to 223 years in prison.
But David Parker Ray was not a well man. In 2002, just 8 months into his sentence, he died of a massive heart attack. He was never convicted of a single murder. So does he really deserve his place on the big hitters list? That's the big question this week. Scuba and sonar searches of the Elephant Butte Lake have not found a single suggestion that there might be bodies filled with rocks lining the floor of the water. New Mexico law enforcement, on the other hand, remain totally convinced that David Parker Ray's victims lie in the desert undisturbed. So, is he America's most prolific serial killer with no body count? Did he get away with murder?
I think yes.
I flip between thinking he's a serial killer and thinking he's a fantasist. Like, I wonder if we accept that he's been doing this for decades and he's killed maybe upwards of 30 people and he didn't make a single mistake, not one.
I don't think he's killed lots of people. I think he accidentally killed some of the women that he held and did this to.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, over the decades, that could have been hundreds. It could have been tens. It could have been hundreds of women. We just don't know. And in that time, he was also picking picking victims that were leading transient lives, that were, you know, we talk about this all the time, people who, quote unquote, aren't going to be missed as much. And I think that, yeah, if a couple of those women disappeared, especially in these circumstances, like we see, these women who are alive and saying this happened to me weren't even being believed. I could believe that he dumped a couple of bodies in the in the desert. But again, that begs the question, well, if he only accidentally killed a couple of women because of what he was doing, does he deserve his place on the big hitters list? In my opinion, yes, because he's so terrifying. The things that he does, this is why I think he's not that well known, because I feel like it's too much for people.
I think the thing is, without any bodies, we'll probably never know. But I will say this as a closing point. If he was hiding bodies, he was incredibly good at it.
I wouldn't put that past him because he was so good at everything he did because he put so much time and care and attention to everything that he did related to this pursuit.
Exactly, exactly. Congratulations, you made it.
You have made it. Well done. Thanks very much, guys. You know the drill. If you would like to, you can come and follow us on all the social medias at Red Handed the Pod. You can also head on over to Patreon and help support the show by making a pledge there. And Hannah, I feel like I've made you do it so many times that I'm going to do it today.
You're going to have to do it because I can't actually read it on my Kindle. But I will say before we go, if you're listening to the last 5 minutes, this is your last 5 minutes bonus prize for sticking it out till the end. From now on, the first Monday of every month, we will be releasing a bonus episode on the Patreon feed for people who are pledging $10 or more. We're going to be making some changes to the pledge structure this week. I know there's been a few discrepancies, so we're on top of that this week. So keep an eye out for those changes. And here are the people who, there's quite a lot because we didn't do it last week. So good luck.
Going to power through. Right. Thank you to Sari, Roseanne Orwell, Mary, Louise, Amy Kasutin, Cole Ortiz, Tanya Hill, Matt James, Beth, Mara Nagler, Kirsty Fife, Hannah, Omega Urban, Megan Hill Smith, Lauren Coleman, Mary Claire Williams, Tonya Maureen Buchanan, Kelly Green, Jess Reedy, Julia Hoover, Janelle Coker Roft, Heather, Gordana Baljikas, Ross Sneddon, Laurie Hedges, Ellie Isenhart, Sarah Monson, yeah. Raphael LD, Felix Rupert, Mark Wynn Ruckhorst, and Anna Frigg.
Frigoletti. Anna Frigoletti.
Good job, mate. That was really good. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.